The book that we're going to be hearing about tonight from the author, let me just say a word about the author first. Francine is an old friend of JTS and the library. You were, in fact, Francine, the first chair of the library's advisory board, right? And have been a friend of the library, you know, for many, many years. So we have always been appreciative of that, and we're, you know, still appreciate everything that you've done. I was going to begin by saying, if you are of the generation that has that was conscious in the late 60s and early 70s, you will have very vivid memories of Golda Meir. I think it's fair to say that all of you were conscious at that time, you know, at least more or less. And so not only will you have vivid memories, but you will be asking yourself, will have asked yourself many times, what happened to the great heroic Golda that I knew? You know, the end of her career brought a reputation that was less than heroic. I confess that I did not in advance have a chance to read this book, but I am absolutely confident. My copies were over there. I bought the first copy when she took them out of the boxes, okay? So I will get back to you as soon as, but I'm quite sure that we will be learning a great deal this evening in advance of the sales, and there are copies outside that you can purchase after Francine's presentation is over. So Francine, come on up. Thank you so much. And before she begins, please turn off cell phones or assure that they won't bother us.
So now, is everybody able to hear me? Yes, okay. So what David doesn't even know is that the library, working in the library, was the first job I ever had in the world. When I graduated from college and from the seminary, Gerson Cohen was the librarian at that time. And he and, I have to say, he and Judah Golden had a fight about which one of them I should work for. And Gerson Cohen won. And so I worked in the seminary library. Now, on my resume, I used to write assistant to the librarian. When you ask Gerson Cohen what I did, he'd say, she's the girl at the circulation desk. So these were different times. But I have had a love affair with this library since those days, and as David said, I have continued to be involved in the seminary library. But now I got involved in Golda Meir, and I'm sorry because I had a piece of a video that I wanted to show you at the beginning and at the end, but it's okay because I'll tell you about it. I wanted to tell you, and the reason that I had this video was I felt that when I began this study, that Golda Meir, even though many people still don't remember her that well, it's very much part of our lives today. She dealt with issues that we're still, the whole world is still dealing with. You know, issues like terrorism, issues like the UN, difficulties with the UN, and other things like that. And so I felt she was very much relevant to our world today, but at the same time, very much part of the history of her own world. I spent, as people here from my synagogue know, more than 8 years researching and writing about Golda Meir, interviewing people in Israel here and there and here, reading in Hebrew and in English, as much as thousands of documents and letters and so on. She was written about, and there was a show about her, there was a television show about her, but I did not feel she was given her due over the years, or that anybody had gone into the kind of depth and breadth I felt she deserved. But not only that, what I felt is that she died 40 years ago. And it's time to look at her from the perspective of time. You know, who was this woman? She, to many of us, many of you remember her as this sort of little old lady, you know, who looked like a bubba and was there on the television quite frequently. She was actually, in her own day, one of, if not the most powerful women in the world. And what I found is she was very, very complex. She was, in many ways, a bundle of contradictions. For one thing, she was sort of the ultimate insider in her government. She was the, worked her way up, she was the labor minister, the foreign minister, the prime minister, and yet, in many ways, she was an outsider. She was a woman in what then was totally a man's world. And she was a woman who came from the United States. She was born in Kiev in Russia, but she lived in the United States from the time she was 8 years old until the time she was 23. And she imbibed the culture of the United States. She was the only one of the founders who did not leave a country where Jews were being persecuted. She left a country where many of our parents and our grandparents had come because it was a country of opportunity. And she gave up that opportunity because she had a vision and a dream, and she went to join those people who had come for different reasons. But that set her apart from the others. And then there was the feminine thing. She was, in many ways, a female icon in her own time and later. She was a very modern woman. She had been married and separated, although she never got divorced, but separated. She became a single parent with two children. She had lovers. She had an abortion in the early years of her marriage. And yet, she totally rejected the women's movement of the 60s and the 70s. That's not to say that she wasn't involved in women's issues. For example, one story she loved to tell was in the early days of the state, there were a spate of sexual assaults, of rapes, in the large cities. And the legislature, in their wisdom, said there had to be a curfew on women so they did not go out in this dangerous atmosphere. And Golda said, the men are doing the raping. They should have the curfew. But there were more serious things. When she was labor minister, she literally pushed through legislation that protected working women and that gave them, for example, if they were hospitalized having a baby, they didn't have to pay. Gave them free paid maternity leave, something we don't have in this country today. So she was very involved in women's things and very modern in many ways. And yet, as I say, she totally rejected the women's movement. Those crazy bra-burning women, she would say. And I thought about why did she take that stand? Well, for one reason, she was a socialist, and she really believed that when society was socialistic as a whole, there would be no need for separate movements. Everybody would be equal, everybody would get what they needed. And that was a very strong feeling she had. But in addition, she was also a very ambitious woman. And at that time, and even today, world leaders do not identify as feminists. And at that time, it would have really hurt her to do so. I sort of hold it against her that she didn't have to say those bra-burning women. You know, she could have just not identified. But she, Golda being Golda, she was passionate about everything. So that was her attitude to that. But even so, at that time, and some of you may remember this, the feminist movement still saw her as an icon. I had edited the book, some of you may know it, Free to Be You and Me. Some of your children or grandchildren knew it. It was a very popular book that I did with Marla Thomas and the Ms. Foundation. And I also edited the first Ms. Reader, which was a compilation of articles from Ms. Magazine, the feminist magazine. And I remember going into the office of Ms. Magazine, and there, as you came in, I think it was in Gloria Steinem's office, was this big poster with a lovely picture of Golda, and the legend beneath it said, "But can she type?" So the women still accepted her until relatively recently, actually. Another contradiction. She was very poorly educated. She never went beyond high school. She finished high school. She went to normal school for about a year, and then she dropped out. And yet, she was the most effective speaker. She spoke without, and I even have notes, but she spoke without notes to the heart. And she was so charismatic and such a good speaker that her colleagues said of her, she could read a page from the phone book and she would have the audience in tears. And then, as I said, she was, many of your memories of her were this kind of, you know, old lady, this grandmotherly looking type of a woman. And she played up that image. She liked it, you know, that people saw her in this grandmotherly way. When she was interviewed once for her talking about everything, she spoke about her chicken soup recipe. And thousands of people wrote in to get her chicken soup recipe. So I put it into my book. But when I looked at it carefully, I got to tell you, don't even bother. Not worth the effort. But the same grandmotherly woman could be tough as nails. She could also be sarcastic. That was her main weapon. She could be cruel if there was somebody who she disagreed with or disagreed very strongly with her. I interviewed a man, some of you probably know him or know his name, Yossi Sarid, who was became an important statesman in Israel. He was not a fan of Golda's, but he had worked for her as a young man. And he said that whenever he had to go in to see her, particularly if he disagreed with her, he would stand in front of the mirror and fix his shoulders back and look into the mirror and say, Yossi, you can do it. You can do it. And then he would go in with his heart beating. So she could be tough as well as grandmotherly. And finally, the contrast I want to talk about, which I will get back to later, is she was revered in the United States and still revered in the United States and many countries of Europe. But she became, in her own country, a controversial figure, and that is what David was referring to. More than controversial, even quite negative among certain groups of people. And there are several reasons for that, and I'm going to, as I say, get back to that. But one is simply misogyny. I mean, there was sexism involved in that. Yossi Sarid, for example, had worked for her as a young man, and he didn't like working for such a powerful woman, and other young men like him. You know, she was powerful and difficult. So after she died, they really began attacking her retroactively. So if she had been, for example, very affirmative, she knew what she believed in, that became, she was, self-involved or self-righteous. If she had been fearless, that became, well, she was arrogant. So there is that. But there's also, and probably the more, main reason, is the Yom Kippur War of 1973, when Israel was taken by surprise, and Golda Meir was the prime minister at the time. So that I will get back to and talk about in a few moments. Now Golda, her story, her life story, reads in some ways like fiction. She was born, as I said, in Kiev in 1898. Her older sister, Shana, was 9 years older than she. Between her birth and the birth of Shana, her parents had 4 babies, all of them boys, all of them who died in infancy. So when Golda came, she was very much welcomed in her family until her younger sister was born, Clara, and then Golda kind of got shoved aside a little bit. Golda and her sisters and her mother came to the United States in 1906. Their father, Moshe Mabovich, had come before, as men did in those days. He came first and then he earned enough money to bring them over. And he settled in Milwaukee. And that was something else that I thought about. What did it mean that she grew up in Milwaukee, not in New York, not in the tenements of New York where so many of our parents or grandparents grew up? You know, in those days, and this I'm sure you know, there were these waves of immigrants coming from Eastern Europe, from Russia and Poland. The immigrants who had come, Jewish immigrants who had come before them, were what were came to be called the German Jews. And the German Jews were very philanthropic, and I see Rabbi Dr. Schorsch is here today, who comes from that background, but they were very philanthropic and very protective in that sense of the East European Jews, but for the most part they looked down on those East European Jews who seemed uncouth to them, not quite as knowledgeable as they were. And so all these Jews, these waves of East European Jews, were for the most part settling in places like New York City in the Lower East Side, in the tenements, or in Chicago and other large cities. And the German Jews were not crazy about having this mass of East European, these uncouth East European Jews in one place, for one thing. And secondly, they felt that if they were to spread out across the land, they would become more Americanized. They would learn American ways. So there were organizations. For example, there was one called the Industrial Removal Office. I hate the name. The Industrial Removal Office. And this organization, their purpose was, their goal was to get these immigrants to leave New York and to go out, west or to go further away from the East Coast. And so Moshe Mabovich, for the most part, this organization was not successful and most immigrants did not move out there. Some did. Moshe Mabovich was one who did, and he settled in Milwaukee. So I thought about what did this mean for Golda not to have grown up the way my parents or your parents did. She grew up in a city in Milwaukee, which was a socialist city. She had already joined the Polizion, which was a socialist Zionist organization, but that was very much reinforced by the progressiveness of Milwaukee, and she was very influenced by that progressiveness. But there was more. She lived in a town that was, at that time, sort of more on the frontier, certainly, than New York City was. It was more open. There were prairies. They had a porch in there in their home. They had a piece of green, a patch of green. They were very poor, but they had those kind of openness that those who grew up in New York did not have. And they also had this atmosphere of the frontier, this sense of can do. You know, you work hard enough, you give your all, and you're successful in the end. And that was also an attitude that Golda very much adopted. And then there was the optimism of the period, but the optimism of spreading out west, of growing, the country was growing. And Golda always spoke of herself as an optimist. A Jew, she said, cannot afford the luxury of not being an optimist. Golda went, her sister moved to Denver, Colorado, and Golda spent some time there. And while she was there, she met a man named Morris Meyerson. Morris Meyerson was a sign painter, but he was a man who loved music, and he loved art, and he loved literature. And Golda, the uneducated, felt that was wonderful. She was very attracted to that. In fact, all her life, she was attracted to men who were very cultured. As you all know, she did have some lovers. I wrote about three of them because those are the ones I could document. I believe there were others. She was very good looking as a young woman. If you look through my book, you'll see some pictures of her as a young woman. Her friend Regina said of her that of every five men who met her, four of them fell in love with her because she was so lively and charismatic. So Morris fell in love with her, and she fell in love with Morris because she was so taken. She was 16, and he was 5 years older than she. At some point, Morris's mother, Shifra, came to visit to meet the Mabovich, Golda's family. And I have some letters that nobody else has that I got from various sources, and they're family letters. And in one of these letters, one of Morris's sisters is writing to another sister, and she is describing their mother's visit to the Mabovich family. And she says that the mother did not think very highly of the Mabovichs. She just didn't think they were worthy of her. But she particularly did not think that Golda was worthy of her son, Morris. So then Morris and Golda went to made Aliyah. They went to British Mandated Palestine. And Morris could never really find himself. He ran a bookstore for a while. He did various things. He really never made it. He sort of was a failure. And Golda, of course, became the Golda Meir that we all know. So I think the lesson is that you got to be very careful when you're being a critical mother-in-law. Well, so by the way, her name, people always get her names wrong, so just, I know you will know it, but I'll tell you again. Her birth name was Golda Mabovich. Her married name was Golda Meyerson, and she was Mrs. Meyerson in all the documents that I read through the time she was labor minister. When she became foreign minister, with Ben-Gurion's great insistence, she changed her name to Meir, and then she became Golda Meir, Mrs. Meir. And by the way, I call her Golda throughout the book, although generally speaking, you know, men are called by their last names, and when it's women called by their first names, it's kind of a put-down. But in Golda's case, I felt very strongly she loved being called Golda. She would tell people from the janitor to the head of a country, just call me Golda. That became her name. And so I felt that was a name, you know, that I should use throughout the book. In 1921, Golda and her friends and Morris made Aliyah to British mandated Palestine. And that was another thing that I thought a lot about. What did she know? What did they know before they went there to this unknown land? They had read books. They had met shlichim from Eretz Yisrael who, you know, spoke about the land and convinced them to go. But really, what did they know? How much did they know about it? They knew it would be difficult. They didn't really know how harsh the land was. They didn't know that it was a land of sand, that they would have to build on sand. But more important, They knew that there was another people living there. Even though there was that Zionist slogan, a land without a people for a people without a land, they knew that there were people there. The Arabs had already rebelled and revolted in some ways. But they felt, and they were right about that, that the land could hold two peoples. But what they really believed and truly believed was that after some time, the Arabs would welcome them because they were bringing with them Western ways. They were teaching, they could teach them how to do agriculture in much more modern ways. And they wanted to do that, and they truly believed that that would be accepted. Well, it wasn't, as we know. Another mistake that they made was there had been a strong Yiddishist movement in the United States at that time. And so they felt that Jews need to speak Yiddish. So even though Golda grew up speaking Yiddish, she had not really learned to write in Yiddish because in America she learned to write in English, and her friends also. But they began writing to each other and speaking to each other in Yiddish. And then, of course, they come to Eretz Yisrael, and the language of that land is Hebrew, and it's being rediscovered. So they were at a great disadvantage. Golda and Morris had settled at Merchavia, a kibbutz, and pretty quickly her leadership qualities emerged. And she was sent to a conference in Tel Aviv where she spoke, she was a speaker and she spoke in Yiddish. And then she went to a conference in Degania. Degania was the first kibbutz that was established in Eretz Yisrael. And she began to speak in Yiddish. And one kibbutznik, and a real Hebraist, got up and stopped her in the middle and said, "It was bad enough in Tel Aviv, but in Degania, no." And Golda was humiliated, but she had to continue speaking in Yiddish because she didn't know Hebrew. Well, of course, she learned Hebrew and had to, of course, the rest of her life she spoke Hebrew, but she was never really proficient in the language. She never was as good in Hebrew as she had been in English certainly in Yiddish. And, Abba Eban, who was very educated and very proper British, used to say about her, "Okay, so she has a limited vocabulary of 2,000 words. Why doesn't she at least use those 2,000 words?" But she got back at Abba Eban because when she was told that he could speak 5 languages, she said, "Well, so does the waiter at the King David Hotel." So Golda and Morris lived on Kibbutz Merchavia. At first, Morris hated kibbutz life. Golda loved it. So then they left. The marriage was beginning to fail. Golda wanted to keep it together. They left and they moved to Jerusalem where they had 2 children. And they were so poor. Morris couldn't earn a living. There was little Golda can do with his 2 babies. She was beginning to do some work, but not much. And they were so poor that Golda had to take in wash from the local nursery school, and with her washboard and wash, she had to plead with the butcher to give her a bone for her chicken, her children's soup. And then in the early 1930s, David Remez, who was then a very important personality in the Histadrut, David Remez offered her a position to work as with the Women's Workers' Council, which was the women's division of the Histadrut, and its counterpart in the United States, the Pioneer Women. David Remez became Golda's lover later, and I believe, I feel very strongly, that of all the men that she knew and loved, he was the man who was truly the love of her life until he died in 1951. So she went to work for the Women's Workers' Council and then the Pioneer Women in the United States, and she came to head those groups. And she worked so hard. She traveled back and forth, between the states and Israel, or pre-Israel, pre-state Israel. She left her children sometimes for 9 months at a time. And she wrote about how difficult it was to leave, it could have been written yesterday by a working mother, how difficult it was to leave her children in the care of a babysitter, as what she called the essay, borrowed mothers. When you miss, the mother would miss out on the child's first words or first steps. And yet, she said, she was not the kind of woman who could stay at home. She was the kind of woman who could not let her life be narrowed by her children. And so she did this work, and she worked very, very hard. And she gradually moved up in the Histadrut into higher and higher positions until she became known by the women and by others. She became a very important force in, pretty important force in pre-state Israel. In 1938, she was sent as a delegate or as an observer, really, to the Evian Conference that, many of you know what that is, Evian on Ben. My accent is not so great, on Lake Geneva. It was a conference that Franklin D. Roosevelt had convened with 32 nations of the world to discuss the refugee problem. The refugees were Jewish refugees. This was before the final, Hitler's final solution. This was when Jews could still escape, more or less, or were being kicked out of the countries that the Nazis controlled. And so this conference was held, what to do with these Jews. There they are, all these refugees. 31 of the 32 countries could find no place for the Jews. Well, we already filled our quota, as they said, or there were too many professionals among them. We can't use that many professionals, or we just don't want Jews causing trouble here. The 32nd nation was the Dominican Republic that offered them a land that the Jews could work, but it was pretty awful land, pretty untillable land. And so Golda sat through this conference, and afterwards there was a news conference and to discuss this. And I just will read you what she said at this news conference. Quote, "There is only one thing I hope to see before I die, and that is that my people should not need expressions of sympathy anymore." And years later, she told a young journalist that conference had been a turning point for her. She said, these people who came, these leaders of the nations, for the most part, were not anti-Semitic, and they knew that Hitler was a bad person. Nevertheless, they could not find any place for the Jewish refugees. And she said, and that made her know without a doubt that the Jews can depend on nobody else but themselves. In 1948, soon after partition, David Ben-Gurion, who was the head of the whole Free State Israel, but David Ben-Gurion knew that as soon as the state would be declared, the surrounding Arab nations were going to invade, and he needed arms badly. They needed money to buy the arms, and they were quite desperate for that. He had sent one emissary to the American Jews at this point, now after the war, was the wealthiest Jewish community. And he had sent one emissary to the United States, and he could not raise more than $7 million. And so he then sent Golda, because he trusted Golda. And she came to the United States, and she had heard that there was a luncheon in Chicago of the Jewish Federation, and that, they were well-heeled people. That would be a good place for her to begin. So she met a man named Henry Montour, who was the executive director of the UJA in Chicago. Montour, later in an interview, said about her, I'd heard her name. I knew her as a schnurrer, used to come to the United States to raise money. She came, he said it was a freezing cold day. She didn't have a dime in her pocket. She walked to meet me at my hotel, but she said, I must speak at that luncheon. And so he arranged for her to speak at the luncheon. And she was terrified. Her knees were shaking. What if she failed? She would have to go home with nothing. And so she spoke. She stood there, this woman with her hair was parted in the middle and back, not a speck of makeup. She looked like a pioneer, like you see in posters. And she spoke from her heart, no notes. And she said to them, she told them why they needed money. She said, we have to buy arms. Otherwise, we're going to be in big trouble. And she ended by saying, you cannot decide whether we will fight. That decision has been taken. We will fight, even if we have to fight with stones. But what you, American Jews, can decide is whether we will be victorious or the Mufti or the Arabs will be victorious. That you can decide. And when she finished, for a moment, there was a moment of silence, and as Montour said, it was like an electric current ran through the crowd. And then she had this standing ovation. People were practically throwing pledges at her. They were so moved and so taken by what she had said. And the next day, she met with the leaders of the UJA and began to travel around the country with them. And by the time she had finished her travels around the country to raise money, she had raised $50 million, which was almost unheard of at that time. Ben-Gurion was very, very grateful. Excuse me, I think I'm going to just take a sip of this. There were other incidents in her life that have become famous. Some of you know she dressed up as an Arab woman to go meet with King Abdullah of Jordan to try to convince him not to enter the 48 war with his Jordanian troops. She failed at that. He was very frightened of the other Arab countries, and he had to do that. He felt he had to do that. Years later, she met with his grandson, Hussein, king of Jordan, to try to swap land for peace with him. And that didn't work either, although Israel and Jordan remained good friends, and she remained good friends with Hussein. She went to the Soviet Union in 1948. She was the first ambassador to from Israel to the Soviet Union. At that time, nobody knew anything about the Soviet Jews. They were sort of what Elie Wiesel would have called the Jews of silence. I mean, the Jews around the world had lost touch with them. They were repressed. Stalin was in charge then. Even though the Soviet Union had supported the partition of Israel and the Arab nations, they did that for their own reasons. They wanted to get more power in the Middle East. But within their own country, they were not happy and did not want Jews to relate to Israel, to identify with Israel. Their whole philosophy was you were Soviet man or Soviet woman, you were loyal to Mother Russia, and that was it. And so Golda went, and she tried very hard to meet with Jews, and she didn't succeed. She met a few here, there. She had an open house, but mostly there were foreign correspondents who came. And then on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, she went to synagogue, to the mosque, the Choral Synagogue in Moscow. And when she came out, thousands upon thousands of Jews, risking their life as it turned out, came out to greet her, to touch her, to call to her, Golda, Golda, our Golda. They put notes in her pocket. They try to touch her, kiss her hem. And she was pushed, somebody pushed her for her own safety into a taxi cab. And she leaned her head out the window and she said, "Thank you for having remained Jewish." And from then on, Golda was very, very involved in the Soviet Union and freeing the Jews of the Soviet Union, that whole movement. Some of it was open when she became prime minister. She spoke openly about it, but much of it was very much behind the scenes. And a man I had, and some of you may know his name, Meir Rosen, I believe he even had been an ambassador. He had been ambassador to France and some connection here to the United States, but he was a terrific man. When I interviewed him, and he was very involved in the Soviet Jewry movement, he said, in the 1990s, 1 million Soviet Jews, as you know, came to Israel. Golda was long since dead. But he said to me, when you write your book, you have to have a headline that says, if it were not for Golda Meir, we would not have had in the 1990s 1 million Jews coming to Israel. She was that involved. There were other incidents. I can't go through her whole life. But in 1949, Golda became labor minister. And she not only pushed through the laws for women, but she developed a very important insurance law that became the basis for Israel's social security, the whole social security system, and for Israel's welfare state. And she was in charge of housing for the thousands of immigrants who were now coming from all over the world to settle in Israel. So first there were tents, and then there were ma'abarot. It was a very difficult job, and she did it well. Golda herself lived so modestly, and so did the others of that generation, so modestly. I mean, I think about world leaders in every country practically today. What a difference. She never tried to get any gain for her children or for herself. And I got to know the family, and I visited. Golda had shared a little house with her son and his family. She lived on one side and he lived on the other side. And when she died, he lived on one side and her daughter lived on the other side. And today, the grandchildren live on both sides of this little house. And I got to know her son and daughter-in-law and the grandchildren. And so they invited me to the house. It was such a tiny house. The living room was so small. It was a fireplace on one side. It wasn't working. They had pictures of Golda on it then. And on this side was a couch and a big coffee table and two soft chairs. and armchairs. And I asked the son, where did Golda like to sit? And he said, she always sat in this chair because it was near the kitchen. And she loved going into the kitchen and serving tea to the people who were visiting, including important dignitaries. So she liked to sit in that chair. Such a modest way of living. It would be nice if we rehabilitated that today in some way. When Golda became foreign minister in 1956 and started many different laws, but what I want to talk to you about is, and she, of all the people who came before her, all the prime ministers before her, she developed a very beginning of a very close relationship with the United States, the relationship that Israel and the United States have today. Under Eisenhower, this didn't exist to that extent. She met with President Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, in 1962 in Palm Beach. He had already met Ben Gurion. Ben Gurion didn't like Kennedy. He said, he looks like a politician. But Golda was so taken with this young man who had become president of the United States. And he was very taken. He didn't like Ben Gurion very much either. But he was very taken with this motherly looking woman. And they had a wonderful meeting. And at this meeting, he said something to her that had never been said to anybody, any leader of Israel before. He said, the United States has a special relationship with Israel comparable to our relationship with Great Britain. And if Israel is ever invaded, we will be there to support her. And that was a very important thing. Golda, when she left, he took her, I read the transcript of this meeting, but this is not in the transcript. When she left, he took her hand, and she always remembered, he looked into her eyes and he said, don't worry, Mrs. Mayor, nothing will happen to Israel. And Israel's relationship to the United States became tremendously important to Golda. And when she became prime minister, and then Yitzhak Rabin was her ambassador, they really created an atmosphere that their embassy was the most important embassy on Embassy Row in Washington. They really developed that tightness with the United States that continued after her time. Golda became prime minister in 1960. I meant to also say, by the way, when she became, I always forget to say this, but I had a radio show today and somebody asked me, what did Golda think about when she, the only woman to be in many positions? And I remember this, that she had said, when she became foreign minister, she was the only woman in the world to be a foreign minister, and the first woman in the world to be a foreign minister. And so newscasters were always saying, Mrs. Mayor, what does it feel like to be the only woman in the world who was a foreign minister? And she would say, I don't know, because I've never been a man. So she became prime minister in 1969, and now we come to the Yom Kippur War. Anwar Sadat, who was the president of Egypt, I'm not going to get into here whether she could have prevented the war, which is something that's said in Israel. I believe she could not, and if you want to ask me about it afterwards, please do. But he was threatening war, but Golda's generals kept reassuring her, there's a low probability of war. There's not going to be a war. Egypt and Syria are not ready for war. And even if there were a war, look what happened in 1967. We killed them, we knocked them dead in no time. Not to worry about it. Golda always had this terrible gut feeling and worrying about it, but her general reassured her. And then, in a few days before the war actually broke out, word came that Soviet advisors in Egypt and Syria, that was the Cold War days, and Soviet and Egypt and Syria were clients of the Soviet Union. Israel was a client of the United States. So the advisors were leaving en masse, very, very hurriedly. And this part, she kept saying, "Well, why? Why would? What's happening?" But she was reassured. Perhaps they think we're going to invade, or start a war, attack. No probability of war. And she had this awful gut feeling. And yet she didn't act on it. And all her life after that, she said, I always depended on my intuition. And the one time when I should have depended on my intuition, I didn't. And she never forgave herself. She said, I'll never again be the person I was before the Yom Kippur War. And what happened in that war is that 2,600 soldiers were killed, a huge number for Israel. Thousands were wounded. And for the first few days, it looked as if Israel was going to lose. They won that war, but it looked as if they were going to lose. It was very, and they lost hundreds of tanks. And Moshe Dayan, the great hero of the Six-Day War, the general, fell apart. He really, someone said he was like a broken man. And Golda Meir, for all of what had happened before that, Golda Meir was a rock. She held that nation together. She made military decisions. She calmed everybody. And even the people who were enemies said, she saved the country in that sense. Israel won the war, as I say, but it felt this sense for the first time of great vulnerability. Not the confidence that it felt after 67. Great vulnerability, because it felt it had almost lost. And after the war, there were protest meetings against Dayan and then against Golda. And in 1974, she retired. Well, didn't retire right away, she resigned, actually. And Yitzhak Rabin was to take over for her. But between the time when she resigned and Yitzhak Rabin was to take over, she still was negotiating. She had negotiated beforehand the separation of troops between Egypt and Israel. And so that was done, and that was the basis for what later became the peace treaty with Egypt. And then she, after she resigned, negotiated the separation of troops between Syria and Israel. And she negotiated very, very hard with Henry Kissinger. It was really tough, and they were really at each other. And you, some of you may have heard this. At one point, Kissinger turned to her and said, "Mrs. Meir, you have to understand that I am an American first, a prime minister second, and a Jew only last." And she said, "Well, that's okay, Henry, because in Hebrew, we read from right to left." So she got that separation of troops, and that armistice with Syria has remained in effect until the chaos today, but remained in effect for decades. When she did resign, finally, she still kept involved. She gave advice to Yitzhak Rabin, who came to her house every Saturday for coffee and advice. And she met with President Ford. She was always involved. And in 1977, when Sadat came to that historic visit to Israel, she was there to greet him along with the other Israeli dignitaries. And when they met, Sadat said to her, "I have wanted to meet you for a long time, Mrs. Meir." And she said, "Well, why didn't you come?" And he said the time was not yet ripe. He needed that war because he needed to equalize. He wanted to bargain with Israel on an equal basis. He needed to equalize things after the humiliating Arab defeat in 1967. So, to sum up, Golda had many flaws. I had a wonderful ending on there. I'm too big, you're not going to see it. It was Golda talking. Maybe I'll tell you what she said. She had many flaws, as I said. She could be rigid, she could be intransigent, she could be sarcastic. She did not understand the Mizrachim, what we call Sfarim in those days, the Jews from Arab lands like Morocco. She was so involved with Soviet Jews, she tried very hard to help these other Jews who had come, many of them from very, very poor. And she started organizations, to help them. But she never really understood them. And they didn't feel she understood them. And that was, in fact, what helped lead to Menachem Begin finally winning in Israel. She certainly did not understand Palestinian nationalism, but nor at that time did almost anybody. The UN spoke of Palestinians as refugees. Most nations dealt with the nations, with Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan, rather than with the Palestinian people. It's unfortunate that that was the situation at the time. And if they did know about Palestinians, they thought of them as terrorists, because there was Arafat with all the terrorism. So she had her failings. But Golda Meir had a vision. And she was someone who did things. You know, I interviewed a woman, a psychiatrist, whose name was Alberta Jalita. And she was doing a study on leadership. And she had met Golda Meir. So she interviewed Golda. She said to Golda, "What can you tell me about leadership? You know, what are the qualities?" And Golda said, "I can't tell you anything. All I can tell you is that I was once on an elevator and five other people got on and they all stood there and I pressed the button." So Golda pressed the button on the United States, on terrorism. She dealt with terrorism and, you know, large-scale terrorism, on her people and on her vision. She left us a legacy of integrity, of hard work, of determination. She said, you know, there are often obstacles in front of you, but you have to overcome them. And she gave her all and overcame them. She gave up her family to a great extent. She gave up her private life to a great extent. She gave up her health. She died of lymphoma that she'd been fighting for 15 years but kept as a secret from the entire nation. She pressed the buttons and she made things happen. Thank you.
Time for questions. I've got a microphone. I'll just make it easier for everybody to hear. So,
yeah, bye.
So two quick questions. In the time I've known you, you've always spoken with not only with passion, but with the wisdom and knowledge and clarity.
Thank you.
So I wonder if you could share with us, in thinking through all the work you did on this book over 8 years, was there one moment in your experience that was the highlight of all the work you did? Second question, while you think about the answer, is Gary Rosenblatt wrote on in the upcoming issue of Jewish Week about, in Between the Lines column, that the Jews are not so much a...
he said they're tribalism.
But it's tribal, and all this conflict between the left and the right. How would Golda have overseen that at that time?
So first of all, highlight, I can't think of one highlight. I guess the highlight was when I finally finished the book. I couldn't believe I had finished it. Now, I think, you know, I wouldn't say the highlight, but I'll tell you something. I didn't begin it as a great fan. I began it because I was interested in, and a publisher asked me to write about her. But I really came, if you'd say a highlight, I really came to admire her. I came, the book has all her flaws in it, and I didn't write a hagiography. But I thought she really was quite a woman. She really did a lot. And I really want people to know that about her. About tribalism, there were the great divisions in Israel between the Sfarim and the Ashkenazim. And that was there and has remained, but I think it's changed somewhat now. I think it's gotten maybe a little bit better, but that was a very bad schism, as it were. And the other thing I will say is not just the nation as a whole. You know, one of the things about these leaders, all of these early leaders, the whole bunch of them, they were always fighting with each other. There was always some, they were mean to each other. And Ben-Gurion was terrible to Charette, for example. And he said awful things. But, you know, with all of that, they pulled together and they created Israel. They created this miracle.
Hello. I read your book with interest.
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
I read your book with great interest, and thank you for sharing with us today. My question, can you please talk a little bit more about Golda's positions in relationship to influence of religious authority in the government? A few times in your book, you mentioned how she regretted the power religious authority got during the formation of the state. Can you elaborate a little bit more on her position?
Her relation to religious authority, as you say. Okay. First of all, you know, somebody asked Golda if she believes in God, and her answer was, "I don't believe in God. I believe in the people who believe in God." And I thought that was a terrific answer for someone who was a socialist and was not religious. You know, she was a politician. So there were times when she did not get along with the religious authorities. She had run, when she was labor minister, she had run for mayor of Tel Aviv. And the religious authorities saw to her that she did not win. She had fought with them earlier because she wanted women to serve in the army, or at least not even to serve in the army, but to do some service for the state. And that caused a great shry and outcry among the Orthodox authorities. So it was a difficult relationship. Nevertheless, in Israel, you know, the government is set up of coalition governments, and she managed always, until the end, and I'll say something about that too, to form a coalition government with the National Religious Party. Mapai managed to, Vada Party managed to form coalitions with the National Religious Party. One of the reasons Golda resigned in 1974, aside from these protest movements about the Yom Kippur War, is that the Gusham Emunim was just about, you know what that is, the block of the faithful, the Orthodox young people, who were very Orthodox and who were very much pushing the need for all of Israel, the greater Israel, which Golda did not believe in. She didn't believe that Israel had to have that much other land. She only was concerned about security and secure borders. So the Gusham Emunim, these young people, were really pushing a religious agenda and pushing this National Religious Party that had always formed a coalition, even though they were religious, with the non-religious, with Mapai and then with the Avoda Party. And they were so influential, these young Gush Emunim people, that the leaders, the older leaders of the National Religious Party, were being pushed in that direction, and it was became exceedingly hard for her to form a cabinet in IAC. She won the election after the Yom Kippur War, but it became exceedingly hard for her to form a cabinet because of that whole religious movement at the time. So it was a very difficult relationship.
So it was rumored at the time during the...
Put the microphone, because I don't hear so well.
During the Yom Kippur War, there were all sorts of rumors as to whether Israel had nuclear weapons. And I was wondering if in any of your research you learned anything about that or had any influence either as to whether they had them, and if they did have them, what Golda's thought process was about whether or not to use them, and the United States influence, and just anything about that whole issue.
Yeah, I do. We have time for a longish answer, David.
The floor is yours.
The floor is mine, I know, but people getting tired. Okay. Yeah, it's a good question. I think everybody recognized that Israel did and does have nuclear weapons. The question came up during the Yom Kippur War. Moshe Dayan came to the cabinet, to Golda and the cabinet, and said, could we use unconventional weapons? And Golda and the cabinet members were absolutely 100% against doing this. Now, I would say this, if they really thought that their country was, truly thought they were going to be totally destroyed, maybe that answer would have been different. I think in some places, as awful as those days were, they knew that the United States was not going to let them be totally destroyed. But nevertheless, their answer was totally against losing nuclear weapons. Now, those of you who saw Golda's Balcony, if you did see that play, it's very much about she had Simcha Dinitz threaten Henry Kissinger that if you don't get us arms quickly, we will use our nuclear capacity. So I interviewed Henry Kissinger at some length. And one doesn't always necessarily believe, everything that people in power tell you. But I did believe him, because he said, absolutely not. That never happened, he said, because were it to happen, whether Israel had nuclear arms was always this, what they call the opacity, it was yes, maybe no, and nobody really knew. Well, were they to threaten the United States, it would have to be open. The United States would have to recognize something that Israel never openly recognized. And that would be a very dangerous thing for Israel. It would really hurt Israel to do that. So he said, absolutely not, that never happened. I also interviewed Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, who has since died. And he agreed that there was never any threat. But he said that what Moshe Dayan did do is he positioned Israel had Jericho missiles that, I don't know the details, but that you could put nuclear warheads on. And so he said that Moshe, and he said, rightly so. He said, as far as I know, Schlesinger said, and I figured that if, you know, the Secretary of Defense of the United States is as far as I know, he knows. So he said, Moshe Dayan so positioned these Jericho missiles that Egypt could see that, you know, don't fool with us because we have something here and you will be in big trouble. Because at the time, word had come back that the Soviet Union was sending nuclear weapons to Egypt. And Dayan needed Egypt to know that. But Schlesinger said as well that Israel never threatened the United States with the nuclear.
Thank you.
So needless to say, that's only the beginning. If you want more, the book is available outside for purchase. Let me invite you to come back for future library book talks. The next one is on Tuesday, November 14th, and it will be an unusual talk because the book is not a book in the conventional sense. It will be artist Avner Maria, who will be speaking about his creative process in creating his Megillah. Pieces of which will be available to be seen, and it'll be an interesting discussion, so please come back then. And then in December we have more talks, so keep your eyes open. Thank you very much for coming.